know, we have a moment of silence before we start the podcast, and you went into prayer mode, Lindsay. It was like reverence before the primary.
Yeah, good habits die hard, I guess.
All right. Well, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression.
Thank you.
I'm your host, John, and next to me is the intrepid Lindsay. Welcome back, Lindsay.
I get an adjective now. That's awesome. Thank you. I'll take it. Go. Well, great.
Adjectives are a good thing. And we have another fabulous panel set up tonight for our discussion. Paulette, you've been a friend for a long time. This is the first time you've come on.
Yes, it is.
And you responded to my Mormon Expression needs more women call.
Yeah, I did.
was it just?
It was the guilt.
Guilt and shame work well with Mormons. And Mormon women in particular.
Well, I felt like I should stand up for my sex, so here I am.
I try to stand up for sex quite often myself. And also, Flip, I know you've been in the basement.
I was in the basement once, and then, like, years ago. I argued a bit with Mike Tannehill at the live event.
You were at the live event, yeah, that's right.
And I think I did a conference review years ago, and I've done a couple of things over at Expositor, too. And I've done a Voices. When Heather was doing Voices, I did one of those.
Great. Well, welcome. And you're a fill-in tonight. We recruited you from the bullpen.
I show up and elbow my way in.
All right. Well, welcome everybody, and thanks again. A couple of early announcements, first of all, and a lot of the congratulations goes to Lindsay. When we set up Whitefields, Whitefields is a couple years old, but when we set it up this year, we had several initiatives. The first one was get the podcast up and running in the studio, and here we are in the studio. And then in March, we were looking for our workshops to get going. We have three workshops, two of them that are about to start. These are workshops really on faith transition issues. One that's women's only that'll be starting here in a week or so. We do have some open spots still on that. Is that right, Lindsay?
Yep, we have a few openings, so you can message me.
So, yeah, you can either go to whitefieldseducational.org, and there'll be a link at the top of the screen that says counseling services. You can click on that, and that'll show you what we have there. We have a list of therapists that we have been vetting. I've been interviewing therapists individually to make sure that they sort of meet our criteria and are people who are experienced working with the issues of transition outside of religion. I talked to another one this week. I have another one that I'm talking to next week. And so if any of you know of therapists who deal with this in particular, make sure to send them my way. We can get them on the list no matter where they are in the world. And then we're doing our workshops. We have the women's one. We have another one just for religious identity.
Disruption.
Mm-hmm. About that, the dealing with the issues that come from your own concept of self and how you interact with the world. And it's a fairly informal group setting. It's led by a clinical therapist, right?
Yes. And what about the couples?
Yes. And I'm happy to announce we kind of finished it out. We have a session. And this one has been getting a lot of attention just on rumor. We are starting in April a session led by two therapists. One of the therapists is an ex-Mormon. The other is a active believing Mormon. And I gave him a bishop's interview myself, to make sure he wasn't trying to fool us. And it's for couples where one member of the couple has left the faith and the other is faithful. That can be extremely difficult on a marriage, as you can imagine. So this workshop is for couples in that situation to try to find ways to sort of rebuild or rebound their relationship in healthy ways outside of that religious barrier. So if that's something that interests you and you're in the Salt Lake City area, you can either email Lindsay directly
at whitefieldseducational.org,
or you can go to the website and there's a link there. I'm also happy to announce that starting this week, our podcast, Mormon Expression Voices, has been rebooted, and we've got some really exciting stuff coming down there. You can find it on iTunes or any other podcast aggregator, or you can go to mormonexpression.com/voices, and you'll find it right there. And the inaugural reboot was Lindsay and I interviewing each other.
It's so interesting.
She made me cry.
I always make them cry. after an arm wrestle. It doesn't take much.
Go check out Voices. All right, so we start each podcast by reviewing news stories. It was a great week in Mormonism. First of all, that some people said it would never happen. Not here, not ever. But they announced this week that the Book of Mormon musical will be coming to Salt Lake City in 2014. Tickets are going on sale, I think, in March. Presently, probably if you don't have season tickets to the Capitol Theater, you're going to have a snowball's chance to actually get them. It's playing from July 28th to August 9th, so it's only like a week or so. So try to get your tickets now.
That would be a great ward activity that you could plan. Don't you think? Get the guys from the ward together.
I think I saw the Book of Mormon musical in Denver. I think it's a great musical, as far as musicals go. But I think that what you need to do when you go see it is forget that it has anything to do with Mormonism. So go see it, but just pretend that – I think there's a lot of ex-Mormons who go like, yeah, we're going to stick it to the man with this. Just forget it's about Mormonism, and then you'll understand sort of the brilliance of the satire and then the message it's trying to get across.
I saw a bootleg of it.
No spoilers. I haven't seen it yet.
Well, what was impressive
Joseph
is that it's really not, like you said, it's not about blasting Mormonism. Mormons is really just a setting. And then Mormons don't need to be scared of it because it's a caricature of Mormonism.
No.
You know? It's the same thing like the God Makers, where I kind of wondered why Mormons have such an issue with the God Makers, where it's like, you look at it, it's like, well, that's not my church.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that guy. And I think it's the same thing with the Book of Mormon, people getting real sensitive about it. No, it's pretty clear what it is. They just took it as a setting, you know, because it's a comedy device, but it's not about Mormons. It's about people and religion and faith and
they do imply
swearing.
That all missionaries are gay, but other than that.
Well, that's
go on.
Because, I mean, look at a missionary lifestyle. So what do? You're with that guy 24/7 for the next 6 months, and you sleep in the same room, and you do everything together, you shop together.
You know, I oftentimes like to throw out ideas for future master's thesis. There is a concept, there is a psychological phenomenon of people who in prison cross over to the other team temporarily and then cross back when they're out of prison. Just saying.
What are we talking about right now?
I don't know.
Missionary. Whoa, wow.
That was one that always bugged me on my mission when they would talk about, you know, when somebody's having a problem with their companion, and they would always say, like, well, you know, this is training for getting along with your future spouse. And I thought, my spouse is going to go to work. And, like, sometimes I'm going to go places. Like, and if I want to go to the 7-Eleven by myself, you know. It's not training for a spouse. Being with somebody 24 hours a day for up to 6 months is not at all what marriage is like.
Clearly, you've never been married to me.
Then you're...
Because it's totally that way.
Hey, Elder, that shower is going a little long in there.
See, now I'm all turned on.
That sounds like marriage.
So right. get your tickets now. It'll be interesting. The news story will be the way the news story, especially Deseret News and those guys react to it. I think my prediction is Mormons are going to try to show how cool they are. You know, like those parents who want to show they're hip by using like slang terms that are 20 years old. That's what the Mormons will be acting like when it comes to town. There won't be protests. That's not their MO.
Dude, the Book of Mormon musical is the bomb. Like that? No?
Lindsay.
I had to think about it for a minute.
I have to take a dollar out of the swear jar for that joke.
I bet you we'll see more of the evangelical sign waivers from conference in front of the Book of Mormon musical. I wonder if there'll be many of those guys out there.
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens for sure. Our next story, New York Times. Last week we talked about New York Times ran an article on feminism in more. It's been a while since I read the first one, and our dear Lindsay was quoted in that article. New York Times. What do you call it when you quote in the New York Times?
I don't know.
Famous. But they did a follow up article. And basically we're talking about how women are pushing for change. Lindsay, you know more about this article. Maybe give our listeners an overview of the article.
Yeah, so the first one is a big deal because it was this big, long, in-depth article about how the mission age is impacting women generally in the church. And the two authors, Laurie Goodstein and Jody Cantor, who did it, are famous for doing this with all religions. They just did one with Orthodox Jewish women. It's just this long, it takes them months and months, and they do it in depth. And so that's what they did, and it was a good article. I think it was a good article. Clearly, you know, not everyone thinks so, but the church put out a statement about it, saying that for the most part it was a decent article. And then the New York Times kind of said that they got such a flood of... So what they did at the very bottom is ask for readers' experiences being Mormon. And so two of my quotes headlined that. And they said they got so many responses for women asking for change that they decided to write a follow-up article. So the follow-up article was about that. And they quoted some women from Ordained Women, the Ordained Women movement, talking about how they don't feel satisfied with the current status of women in the church. I'm trying to think of... Oh, and they corrected something. There was this big, this little kerfuffle, I guess. Nyland McBain, who does the Mormon Women Project. I don't know if you guys have heard of it, but it's a great project. Do you know what that is?
He does the Mormon Women Project.
Nyland McBain is a she. Oh. And she highlights faithful Mormon women that, like, you know, are physicists or things like that. And anyway, she got lumped in with feminist Mormon housewives.
It's like the church's thing.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I'm with you.
So she got lumped in with feminist Mormon housewives in the first article, and that upsets her because they said that it was a place for women to vent their frustrations.
Mm.
So in the second one, they corrected it.
Women should keep quiet.
Yeah, so they corrected it. Sorry, you probably didn't want this in depth. It interests me. So they wrote a follow-up, and the follow-up has had a follow-up news story last night, and... it continues to keep rolling forth like a stone cut without hands.
Yeah, so it is a polarizing thing, the push for reform. Of course, among liberal Mormons and ex-Mormons, there's those who want to see a lot of change, and there's those who think it's wasted effort. But you look like you have something to say, Lindsay.
I think we could have a whole podcast on this.
I think we could too. It's sort of like, look, if you're a vegan.
Oh, here we go.
and you go to the, like, the U.S., like, Cattlemen's Association and try to promote them towards veganism, even to a small degree, you're wasting your time. That's all I'm going to say.
Sure, if you were a vegan and there was a cattle association, but
because the way
that
the
metaphor doesn't translate.
The way the cattlemen look at cattle, they have they have no interest in vegans.
We'll definitely follow up with
to the cattlemen. The cows are not equal.
Sure.
They're a commodity.
They're equally delicious, yes.
But what they're trying to do is to get the cattlemen to treat the cows better before they slaughter them.
Right, but they're cattlemen. They're not going to treat...
That was harsh.
This whole thing, the thing I can't understand, I can't wrap my head around, is what does it mean to believe in an organization that you want to fundamentally change? You know, do you believe... do you not believe in the Mormonism that is, and you will believe in the Mormonism that ordains women? What is it?
Well, I mean, I can see, I can give the counter argument. There's a lot of stuff the U.S. does. I hate drones. I think these are immoral in any circumstance. I want to see that changed. And if somebody comes to me and says, hey, this is the U.S., you know, love it or get out, I'd say, no, I'm part of it. So I can actually see that wanting to change. And you're right, Lindsay. We have, because I get a lot of people who say to me all the time, what are you talking about? The church changes all the time. Because I say the church cannot give on this one. They can't change on this front. And well, we'll just leave that as a teaser for a future smackdown.
And you can, all you ex-Mormons can pray for my Stockholm syndrome. Just pray.
Oh, you poor thing.
Well, there's some of us ex-Mormons that still, you know, have women in the church that we care for, and we just want them to be treated better. And we know they're not going
to
leave.
Amen to that.
But we would just like them to be treated more humane.
I'm all for that.
Like the cattle.
Go ahead.
Hey, my name is Kessie. Just throw that out there. But one thing I wanted to chime in One of the big reasons that was my break point with the system in general was when I looked at past precedent. And if you look at Joseph Smith, and this is one thing I don't understand why the feminists don't jump on, but when I read through like Todd Compton's In Sacred Loneliness, he, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, they were taking their wives with them to give blessings, as in laying on of hands and talking in tongues and doing a whole bunch of stuff that right now if the women did, it'd be like, what? So my question is, if Joseph Smith did it back then, to what degree did they have that ability? For example, one gave a gentleman a blessing where he was going to be one of the 144,000. Like, she laid her hands on his head, one of his wives, ordained, and I don't know if ordained's the right word, but just gave that blessing and said, this is what happened. So if they could do it back then, and it was already set as precedent, same with blacks in the priesthood, you know? If you look back, Joseph Smith did that, even though Brigham Young and whoever shut it down, the past precedent was always in place to be more open, and it just kind of seems like they just shut it down. So, I don't know.
Feminists still bless each other. They still have blessing ways and healing circles and baby blessings and all kinds of things. And we do. That is a big argument that Mormon women used to do it. In fact, I've done a few YouTube series highlighting those women to try to get it out to the general public. We've had it countered from some pretty impressive scholarly Mormon women who claim that it's not the priesthood, that it was a separate form, and there's this huge debate in Mormon feminism going on with that.
And we all need to be careful, myself included, whenever we talk about feminism. Talking about feminism is like talking about Christianity. There's a lot of schools of thought, and when you talk about Mormon and ex-Mormon feminists, there's a lot of different competing theories out there of what should be. And we sometimes talk about it as if it's this monolithic mass, and of course, you know, as well as anybody, Lindsay, that's not true.
I will say that I have been blessed by a woman before. It feels so scandalous to say that.
Did it work the same?
Yeah. One of the women was from the Community of Christ. I had her give me a blessing with her priesthood, and that was a good experience for me. That was an experience I value. So
I think they could just improve blessings generally if they move away from olive oil. And, I mean, they've already got all those essential oils down in Utah County. I mean, most people have garages full of them. Bless some of that, and then you get the blessing and a nice smell on your head. That's got to be nice.
And
you
know, speaking of olive marketing. Oil,
I've been told that, I don't know if I should go, those, you know those little vials that people carry their blessed oil around? Like, do you guys know where I'm going with this? If you're like, I don't know, like a stockbroker, you carry in your cocaine and those things. They don't like go to Deseret Book and buy them. I'm sure they get them from a head shop or something. But sometimes those are mistaken.
Is that one of those stories that you missionaries tell to each other on the missions? Like, hey, you know, like Steve Young, like I knocked on his door. I helped baptize the dude.
How come when you're talking like a man?
I'm talking like a Mormon man. That's totally like Mormon men sit around and do.
Semi-gang gestures going on. Yeah. Like, you're throwing gang signs. And you're talking slower and like using shorter words.
Yeah, bro.
All right. Enough of your sexism. All right, let's move on to the next story. Today, this is the 11th, March the 11th, BYU announced a new president, Kevin Worthen. There's a lot of stuff here to unpack. Kevin is a BYU man through and through. He got his undergraduate degree and his law degree from BYU. He is the former dean of the law school. He is an inside man, which is one of the criticisms coming against BYU these days more seriously, both inside and outside, is they're becoming very insular. And anybody familiar with higher education knows you generally need to go to a different region, and it's very much encouraged that you don't do your education all in one particular place. That's very much frowned upon. So here's an institutional man. And even though this is a kind of a quiet war, since Rex Lee, there's been inside fighting at BYU about control of BYU. Now, if we go back, of course, there was Ernie Wilkinson, who was the he was the Stalin of of BYU. The man is actually responsible for a lot of what we know as Mormon culture today. You know, like the not being shaven. And I've joked before, the BYU was the counter culture of the time, but it was absolutely true. And that was driven by Ernie Wilkinson. He set up a secret police down there. He had students ratting each other out. It was a really terrible environment.
And that still happens.
Still happens to some degree, but not like it was in the 60s and 70s. After Wilkinson, we had two guys in a row. You'll recognize their name, Oaks and Holland. And following Oaks and Holland, there was the president was Rex Lee. And the word on the street has been for years that Rex was being groomed for the Quorum of the Twelve. The only thing that I can contribute to those rumors, other than just passing them along, I've said before, I worked for BYU police, and I did security at his house one time, Rex Lee's, before he passed away, and we shut down the whole fucking, like, block in Provo. Like, BYU police went out on the Provo streets and closed it down, and the 12 had to walk into the party, and they were all walking by us. Some of them were nice, some of them were kind of dicks, I will say that. So he was a BYU insider, and he got, I think, cancer or something. He died very young. He died when he was in office. He was in his, like, early 60s or late 50s. There was a lot of pushback at BYU at the time. If you remember in 1993, this is when the purgings came. You can read Brian Waterman's book, about BYU academic freedom, what was going on there. And so, there was a lot of talk. I remember I was at BYU at this time where people were saying, you cannot, criticize the administration, even on academic things, because you have a temple covenant not to criticize church leaders. Rex Lee dies, and they immediately put in Merrill Bateman, a general authority. So then it's like, ha ha, fuck you guys. You can't criticize the president of the university anymore because now he's a general authority. And people were actually saying this. The problem was Bateman came from, I think, Mars Company. Like he he made a couple of tactical errors. The first one is he did this huge remodel on his office, and it got out that he had spent $30,000 or $40,000 in mahogany. But his big mistake was he plagiarized a talk. It was an academic talk. He got caught red-handed plagiarizing. And if you remember the mid-90s, this is when plagiarism was coming out of the smoke because software was now getting sophisticated enough to spot plagiarism. And the insiders say this ruined Bateman's career, that he was on track then also to move to the 12. But then he got left there long enough, then he got kind of put out to pasture, which is good. He's kind of an asshole. He was followed by Cecil Samuelson, who they played an interesting move here. They picked an emeritus general authority. So he had the mantle of authority, but he probably wasn't as politically inclined as Bateman was, you know, as a much of a ladder climber. And Cecil's tenure has been just sort of meh, like nothing's really going on at BYU. And then Worthen, if you look at that history, I think is a response to all that. They've got an inside guy. The law school and the business school are what the church really cares about at BYU. That's where they put all their money. So, that's a grooming position. And I think, one of those two, I think, was also the dean of the law school. I can't remember. I don't think it was Oaks because he was on the Supreme Court before he took that position. So here you see an inside guy. It'll be interesting to see what happens at BYU. One of the articles that I read about this out today reported that freshman applications are down at BYU for the first time in a lot of years. They were attributing it to the change in mission policy. That now a lot of kids are just going off and they'll be that will come back. But that's one of the things that they noted as a issue for him.
They did say on the newsroom release something interesting. They said the search committee appointed by the university's board of trustees considered many outstanding, well qualified men and women for the position.
I saw that too. It's in my notes. And here is my look, every time people say, let's go back to the women thing. Every time people say the church is about to.
Please, let's go back to the woman thing.
All right, don't make me feel bad. Every time people say they're about to ordain women, I point out, because they say religions have to secede to, you know, cultural pressure will make them do it. Then I say, well, yeah, just like cultural pressure has made the Catholics make divorce okay. Like these things stick around for a long time. But I thought that was fascinating that they actually said that, hey, we consider both men and women. But if the church were really concerned about real movement on this issue, this was a golden opportunity for them. Can you imagine if they'd put a woman in charge of BYU? That would have been a wonderful precursor to any sort of change they'd have coming down, because they could change the attitude that women don't have to just wear those stupid pastel suits and talk in that voice. Do you know how to do the voice?
I absolutely know how to talk in the voice, John.
this would have been a brilliant move for them. And the fact that they chose not to shows that it's like the groundhog seeing a shadow or not seeing a shadow, whatever. The fact that they didn't do that, I think it was a real loss for them.
Well, like you explained earlier, they painted themselves into a corner, because if the president of BYU needs to be an ecclesiastical authority, he can't have a woman in there.
Right.
Because when they come to the professor and say, listen, I'm concerned about all this talk about mitochondrial DNA and Eve, and they go, well, you're not an ecclesiastical authority.
Right.
He can pull out his little vial of cocaine and put it on somebody's head.
Well, and from what I understand, the general authority, the 12 in particular, are very, very concerned about BYU. It's one of their biggest things. And I remember I went to a fireside there, or whatever they're called, and President Hinckley spoke at the time, and he said the BYU is the church's single biggest expenditure. Think about all the money that the church is spending all over the place, and that's significant. And it's hugely subsidized, that education, that they're getting a good return for their dollars for it. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. It's all about fiscal stuff for the church.
Well, and you get so many women that start their degrees and then get married and never finish them. So I think to have a woman as the president might encourage more women to go to BYU and finish their degrees, might actually help.
Are you saying, is that what they want, or they don't want that?
Well, they should want it.
I think they're afraid of that.
MRS degrees go lead you to be the president of
Well,
BYU.
They don't count for anything, really.
So I don't know. It would have been.
Oh, they count for plenty in the home.
It would have been interesting. I didn't believe, you know, when I went to BYU, I thought that was a rumor, but then the girls would stand up in the ward and say they were here just trying to get married. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely real. I was floored by it.
You see that less at the U, but you still see it.
Really?
Yeah.
We called my student directory the menu. We did.
Last, Uchtdorf, the silver fox.
That's right, baby.
gave a speech at BYU on Friday, and he said, that, I'm going to quote right from it, "Mormons shouldn't shy away from their religious history, but neither should they be quick to discard their faith if what they learn appears inconsistent with LDS teachings." They said a member of the government, the member of the blah, 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 Uchtdorf said. So you shouldn't discard your faith even if it's inconsistent with its faith? Wow. Another quote. "There will be times when it may appear that things are going badly for the truth of God, that the evidence of the world contradicts God's utterances." For my part, I have learned to be patient, knowing that in the end, things will work out. There's a couple of really important things here. But the main thing is, and I've made this point before, that the church is always true in all the evidence that hasn't been discovered yet and all the things we haven't found. And this is really, to me, a tacit acknowledgement that the gate's game over, right? It's 300 years. Don't be wrong. It's 300 years before this is all set up. This is game over. When you're saying, we know we've lost, but something's going to come along and make us win in the end.
There's a third item from his speech. He relayed the story of Frederick the Great, and during the war, a deserter was brought to him, and he talked to the deserter and said, "Why did you leave?" And he said, "Because I was terrified, and you know, I didn't think we were winning, and I, you know, couldn't stand it." And Frederick the Great is purported to have said, "Give me another week, stick with me for another week, and if it still goes badly, I'll desert with you." Why did he tell that story? So everybody's going, why did you tell this Frederick the Great story about if it's all, you know, if it all goes south, I'll go with you? What does that say about Uchtdorf?
Well,
Tom Phillips has won. That's what it says.
Tom Phillips is going to win. I'm kidding. What I think it is, Thane, I think that's an excellent point, but I think you're giving it more thought than he did. From my upbringing, the church, the Jesus was always about to come. It was always right around the corner. It was always just hang on for a little bit longer, and that's what it will always be. That's the root of fundamentalism.
No,
I'm with Thane. There's a rumor that Uchtdorf is a lot more progressive.
The rumor is that he's kind of winking at us and saying, I'm one of you guys, and if this all goes really south, I'm with you.
Yeah, no, and there is some evidence to support that.
I don't doubt that he's putting that message out. I just doubt the fact that it's real.
My personal opinion is I think he's trying. I honestly do. I think that he seems like a good guy and he's in a hard spot and I think he's trying. That's my personal take.
Well, and really what he's saying to the believers is this, it's the same thing they've always said, which is like, you know, we might not understand it in this life. It might not make sense in this life, but just wait until you're dead and, you know, it'll all be revealed.
But with the caveat of your perspective isn't the only perspective. Keep an open mind. Which is a good message, a message we should all embrace.
I think
that
they have set up Uchtdorf, because Uchtdorf is a blessing for them as far as PR amongst the 12. They're really putting him out there as the anti-packer. You know, I think he's the guy who goes and says stuff to the sort of general Mormon, non-Mormon, everybody community, and all this kind of fuzzy stuff with the, you know, doubt your doubts, all this stuff. They're always going to still have the Oaks and Packers back there laying the hammer down. I think he's just a PR tool and they're pushing him out there because he's so damned likable.
Could be. I mean, who's coming up? People like Bednar and Cook? Ugh.
Well, it's a way for them to speak out of both sides of their mouth.
That's what I'm saying.
Make everybody feel comfortable
and
in one way or another.
Even the very elect shall be deceived in the last day. And maybe he just wants to sin. Maybe he's offended. I don't know. All right. Those are our stories for the week. Thanks. All right. So, 1 Nephi chapter 1 is probably the most single read chapter in all of American literature. Not in terms of volume, but just in terms of run throughs. You know, And the Book of Mormon has been published in mass quantities. I have probably 15, 20 copies of it myself. So it's out there. And I thought for tonight we would take advantage of our opportunity we have in the modern age to read the scripture and to go through the first four verses. I don't think we need to make it any further than that. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight.
Well, I just want to tell everyone, I have been reading up on the apologist essays, and there's a lot to cover on the first four verses.
Yeah.
But I would like to say, because last time we were talking about philosophy with Dennis Potter.
Yes.
You know how many messages I got, people thinking I'm a moron? Because I represent a different viewpoint doesn't necessarily mean this is my viewpoint. So I would like to put that out there. If I'm arguing for Ferris' position, it does not mean that I don't care about Reformed Egyptian. I don't.
Did you just call Ferris's position moronic? That's what I heard.
I just said I'm ambivalent about it. That's a whole topic for another discussion. But please don't send me messages telling me that I'm an idiot. All right.
Well, at least not for this.
There are plenty of reasons to do so, but not because of Reformed Egyptian. Please.
People send me those messages too about you. No, that was awful.
That's
no,
a good one.
No, I'm just, that's terrible. All right. So.
Yeah, send him to John. Don't send him to me.
So let's go back. Let's go back in time to the time Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon.
I thought we were going back to Israel.
No, well, we're gonna go back there soon enough. But 1827 to 1830, he's writing the Book of Mormon off and on, and he goes and he pens 116 pages of text, right? And it was taken by Lucy Harris, and I'm sure she burned it. So Joseph Smith now has a quandary. And this is sort of, the quandary is actually outlined in church history. Because if he produces it again and it doesn't match, he's got a problem explaining why it doesn't match. And that's the quandary, really, because if you we've all not saved, right? and you know, it's always better. That was some good shit there, man. So I want you to keep in mind that Joseph Smith has to restart his thesis, his paper here again, and he doesn't want to tell the whole goddamn story again. So I would plant in a seed of doubt in your mind. I would ask you that when you read the Book of Mormon, especially the first few chapters in Nephi, ask yourself, does this read like chapter 2 of a book? Or does this read like chapter 1 of a book where chapter 1 previous version went missing? What does Pharaoh say about that?
I didn't read actually on that.
Okay. I just read
on the divine origins why the wording itself makes it true.
Okay. All right. We'll get there.
Yeah.
So, I don't pretend to believe things I don't believe. I believe Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon. Whether he had help or not is a semi-interesting question, but, so these 116 pages have been written, and now he's got to pick the story up, but he's got to do it in a way that he knows that those pages might eventually turn up. So from here's your sort of game theory. You know it's out there, and you know you've been writing a book, and there's elements in that book, that chapter, that are necessary for your story. But you know if it ever turns up, you have to have a plausible explanation. But because the story you've kind of worked out in your head has to continue, because if he'd started it over, because ostensibly it was the Book of Lehi, and there wasn't just one person who saw it. There were like 5 or 10 people. I don't know how many people had read the 116 pages, but there were a few that had read it.
Do we know who took the dictation of the 116 pages, or did he rip them out by himself? Do we know who actually wrote them down?
That's a good question. I don't know. We do know that, you know, like if you read Skousen's book on the original, I think Skousen's talk about, others have. There are still places in the Book of Mormon where we haven't identified who the scribe is. So the who is scribing the Book of Mormon is more complex than the church represents it. Because, you know, they say Harris for a while, and then Emma, and then Cowdery is basically their answer. But I think we have one of the Knight brothers has some, Phelps. So there's some others who are riding along. And I think Smith's own hand is in there at some point, but I'm not an expert on this sort of thing. So, Flip, that's a great question. I don't remember who wrote the first 116. I think the church history would say it was Harris, because he was going back to Lucy and saying, look what I've been doing. Isn't this wonderful? And she's like, what?
Maybe the 116 pages is where Joseph and Oliver were just sitting at the table politely without a hat or a curtain or nothing.
And this is before Oliver comes wandering into the picture.
Oh. I tried to give it the church an out there. Oh well.
Well, what's really curious is that Joseph has received so many convenient revelations. It was interesting that he couldn't get any help on where those pages went. If they even were around still. He could have said, they were destroyed, so it's all good.
And it's a fascinating point, because if you read the rest of the book, or you read Modern Revelation, the Doctrine and Covenants, or you read the Bible, there is nothing in all of that as specific as to the revelations about the 116 pages that appear later in the Book of Mormon, right? It comes, and it later in the Book of Mormon, the story of losing the 116 pages is embedded in this book that's supposed to be from... from 1800 years earlier in Meso-fucking America, and they're telling this little story, this little nitty story out of church history, and nowhere else is it ever that clear.
Well, they're prophets, seers, and revelators, so.
In this aspect.
They thought it would be important to write down on those gold plates, you know.
So Smith has the Book of Lehi that he's written. He now knows that that might show up. He's got to start the Book of Nephi. he knows that he can't have a direct match. But what I would say is, now let's go to the actual narrative of the Book of Mormon. The actual narrative of the Book of Mormon is that Nephi took his father's plates, and then he copied them down. But then everything else was reorganized by Moroni. So you have this common narrative. Well, let's look at stylistically. This second chapter of the Book of Mormon, which is the first chapter in our Book of Mormon, recaps the first chapter that's missing. In what other book in the Book of Mormon is there a recap of the previous book? In what other book does it ever say, just to make clear the story so far, you have these characters that were in the previous chapter. Does that ever happen again in the book? Does it ever happen in any book? Are you ever reading like Lord of the Rings and you're like in chapter 4? Just to be clear, in chapter 3, Tom Bombadil was walking through the forest singing his little song, and we just want to make sure you're clear. No, they do that in serial movies or whatever when you're losing the first one. But to me, it's absolutely positively clear what Smith is doing. He's hedging his two bets. He doesn't know if this is going to show up or not, and he has to start the book over.
Just to answer your question, I looked it up. I think it was Frederick G. Williams that was filling in.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
For Sidney Rigdon at the time. So.
All right.
Do we know how many testimonies the whole 116 pages episode cost? I mean, this fellow, right, his name only rings a little bell. Did he go on into a career in the church? Or
because we know the, Harris?
Well, no, Harris, the guy described Williams. This I forget the name.
Frederick G. Williams? He was in the first presidency.
He went on for a long time. Because we know Harris dropped away.
No. Harris says that he never left the church. The church left him. He stayed in Kirtland, right? And everybody else just took off. Yeah, so. And Harris is buried up in, like, Cache Valley, right? He eventually came out.
It's obviously impossible to know, but how big was the circle at that early during the period of the 116? Because there's only a handful of people that would have had any intimate knowledge about any of this, right?
This is your first meeting of the church. You know, the church says there's six members. I think there were like 20 or 30 people at that meeting, and that's down the road from this event. So this is really just a couple of families and a small circle of people.
And this is also when Joseph was, I don't know, not living underground, but, and I mean, he'd been thrown out of Emma's dad's house and all that, right? I forget. Like, I mean, he was not in good standing. There wasn't a community that he was really welcome in.
I don't know the sequence of events, but it was really small at this point. That even like the concept of being a church, it was more like the Smith sort of folk religion, yeah. And there was this underground network of other people who were treasure diggers and kind of occultists.
Yeah, I'm getting this was before it got mainline.
1828 was when he married Emma.
Yeah. So I mean, like, because at this point he was still that goofy Smith kid, treasure digger, guy who eloped with that nice girl and broke his dad's heart, broke her dad's heart, all that stuff. Like, so.
Yeah, but there was some context. There was, I mean, Joseph was already talking about this kind of stuff before, so there were rumors around him, and I think that as many detractors as he had, he also had followers starting to accrue too. So.
He wasn't like an outcast
everywhere he went.
At this point, he was a lot more the goofy guy with weird ideas, you know, downtown, and not the guy starting a religious movement that everybody's got to start taking seriously, because obviously it went from the first thing to the second thing very fast.
Right. Okay, so once again, I believe Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon. And the dream that Lehi has that starts in verse 5, we're not going to get into verse 5, was a dream that his father had had, that his father had had and relayed. Now, for these early folk Mormons, this was proof that it was true. In a kind of backwards, naive sense that none of the rest of us would buy into now. But the fact that Joseph Smith wrote this book and, oh my God, here's the same thing we heard from Dad like 5 years ago. This must be true. and because they were all mystics. I know I'm being kind of rude when I describe them that way, but they were all very occult driven, very mystical in their thinking, and they would see signs And, I mean, if you think about the occult or mysticism, that's part of what it is. You throw down shells or look at tea leaves, and you're seeing signs, and you're seeing communication, you're seeing metaphysical manifestation all over the place.
And his dad and brothers had already had visions in the woods.
Well, I don't think it's that crazy within the religious Christian context. You know, it's the same thing as, hey, look, the Old Testament predicts the events of the New Testament. Who would have guessed?
Right. Yeah. And they would see those things coming towards them, and they saw, just like we all do, human beings see this colossal meaning in their own lives. The hubris and arrogance that we all have had, all Christians, for 2,000 years, that we think Jesus is about to come, is so egocentric. And so we think so much of ourselves that we're it, man. We're the fucking chosen generation. Watch out. And it's incredible. But the people who really buy into that and then start selling it back, it becomes this sort of echo chambery sort of thing. Now, where I'm getting with the Book of Mormon is that model that you have Father Smith having this vision and then younger Smith, Joseph, who picks it up and has the vision again himself. He gets the plates. And younger Smith has two older brothers, right? So you have Father Smith, and then you have all these kids, two older brothers, and then younger Smith. And when you're not the first brother, you kind of have to explain why you supplant the heir apparents as the new sort of spiritual heir. So that's Smith. We're talking about Smith. So let's talk about the Book of Mormon. You have Lehi, who is the visionary. Then you have Nephi, who's the third son, who has the same vision again, who has to supplant. And the book starts out egotistical. Like, the one thing that should, when we read verse one, that should hit you right in the face is this Nephi sure thinks he's the fucking bomb. He thinks he is it.
I just want to say, I don't think it's that simple. I mean, if you read Quinn's work, he talks about astrology factoring into this, and Lucy Mack thinking that Joseph Smith makes you know, the dad the patriarch and blah, 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 blah. So I can see what you're saying, and I see the pattern, but I wouldn't say that the Book of Mormon is exactly like Joseph, you know, getting his, getting attention.
Well, and this time in history is very, very interesting. As far as spiritualism, it was like the birth of spiritualism, and you have all sorts of things going on, especially in the upstate New York area. So, I mean, for people to believe that an angel came to Joseph is not that far-fetched as it would be at other times in history.
No, this has been pointed out by other historians that you know, they talk about what did you know, Joseph talks about the clergy reacting to him, and historians would say, no, everybody was seeing angels. That you weren't marking yourself as special. And because
I'm sure they argued with him, just like they were all talking religion.
Well, it'd be like me saying to you, hey, God told me we should all wear blue on Wednesday. You'd be like, no, he said green, man. He said green.
Well,
it
you
was
had
that
a lot
kind
of
argument.
You had a lot of people seeing spirits, you had a lot of seance things going on, the table tippers, stuff like that. So I mean, like, everyone was seeing spirits.
The itinerant preachers and the big problem for the burned over district in the frontier was they got out in front of the churches, which meant there was nobody clerical to like correct them, saying, that's not really how it goes. So their imagination sort of ran off with them. And not that what they were saying on the frontier was that inferior to what the clerics had to say. It's just they were keeping it in check. That's what didn't happen in cases like this. So we have the beginning of the Nephi narrative. Verse 1. You can get out your...
I, Nephi.
You can get out your scriptures.
Having been born of goodly parents.
Do you have this memorized?
Therefore, I don't remember. Brought up and then...
I, Nephi, having been born of goodly... Okay, so the first thing I want to point out to you is... Joseph Smith has a big problem with run-on sentences. This is the first thing.
No, I would say ancient Hebrew does, but that's...
Whoa, now, let's not get to verse 2 yet.
But didn't they use concise characters in Hebrew?
Easy, guys. All right, so verse 1. I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents, therefore I was taught somewhat in the learning of my father, and having seen many afflictions in the course of my days, nevertheless, having been highly favored of the Lord in all my days, yea, having had great knowledge of the goodness and the mysteries of God, therefore I make a record of my proceedings in my days. That's how the whole Book of Mormon reads, by the way. If you've never read this book, that's kind of how it goes. So, highly favored of the Lord, goodly parents, and a great knowledge. He's not really shy about
not very humble.
Speaking his own virtues, which to me makes perfect sense if you're taking Nephi as an alter ego for Joseph. Because then he can put all his positive eggs in that basket. Because it's not really Nephi saying he has goodly parents and he's highly favored of the Lord. It's the alter ego, Nephi.
Okay, so when I hadn't read this in a long time, even though I've read it many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And that being born of goodly parents is such a cliche in the church. You hear that over and over and over again. Whenever people write in their journals, they'll be like, I, Paulette, being born of goodly parents, you know, because it's like you want to emulate this. But I also remember, like, in seminary hearing that Joseph Smith had referred to himself as being born of goodly parents. And I looked it up, and actually in the Joseph Smith papers, in his own history, that's how he introduces himself,
mm-hmm.
which is very interesting that he would use the exact same phrase that he used in the Book of Mormon.
The language.
Or,
the
exact language.
Or this scripture proves the authenticity of the Book of Mormon.
Say more. You've piqued my curiosity.
So there's this word that most of you probably don't know because it's too scholarly for all of you. It's called a colophon. Have you heard of it?
No. Say more.
It proves the Book of Mormon is true. So, from the fair scholars, they say, from the day the Book of Mormon was published in 1830, some readers have been struck by its distinctive modes of expression.
Mm.
Many of the oddities, thought at first to be signs of ignorance or awkwardness, turns on closer inspection to be traces of ancient authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
Colophons in the Book of Mormon illustrate this. And what they go on to explain is this strange wording like, I, Nephi. I, Enos. I, Mormon, make a record of these things. I, Jacob. Those are colophons, and they appear in ancient Egyptian documents.
Okay.
You know where else Hebraisms show up? In the Old Testament. In fact, in the King James Bible, you get Hebraisms.
You're not doing your argument any favors.
Let's talk a little bit about
that. That was an ancient document, too.
Okay. So, to find, let's say I have a new drug that I want you all to take. This new drug is the drug that everybody's looking for. Do you guys know what the number one drug that all the drug companies want? What? That's exactly right. Women's Viagra. That is the golden fleece of the drug companies. I'm not, but you can look this up. This is what they want.
I don't want an erection for more than 4 hours.
You do know that Viagra does exactly the same thing in women that it does in men. It just has a different psychological effect in women than it does in men.
I can give you plenty of articles about the hymen. Is that what we're talking about?
I think the hymen is a myth. I don't think it actually exists.
Okay. Change the subject.
All right. So what were we talking about anyway? We were talking about, okay, statistics. So I have this new drug. That I say, if it's, this is Spanish fly, man. And so I take a group of women and I give them my Spanish fly. And I take a group of women and I give them placebo. And then I measure the distance between the difference between the two. So I can't say, hey, when I gave these women Spanish fly, 10 of the 100 were ready to dance. I can't say that. That's meaningless. It has to be compared to a base case. This is John the linguist talking to you. What these guys at FAIR do all the time is they say, look at this. Here's Sumerian, ancient Sumerian. And here's the Book of Mormon. And look, we have 15 points of connection. What they've never done, and I've talked to these guys directly on it, say, show me any two random languages and tell me what the base case is. What is the base case of convergence? Because there's not that many phonemes in a language. And there are, in every single language, there are words that randomly are the same. If you pick any two languages and line them up, there'll be words that have the exact same meaning, even though languages have no connection to each other.
And it's called false friends, isn't it, the term? It's a false cognate or false friend?
A false friend is when you think a word, you're learning another language, and it has a meaning that sounds like the meaning in your language, but it's actually different. So it's true that there's parallels between English that Joseph Smith is using, which he's taking King James English, which is a translation from Hebrew and Coptic and Greek, which were influenced by these old languages. So it's not like one of them was on Mars and one of them was on Jupiter. There is an actual known connection between the English and the Bible and the structures and these other things. So to make that case, you would have to actually statistically show what the base case is and show that statistically there is more connection to the Book of Mormon English and to Sumerian than, say, to the Book of Mormon English and, I don't know, Swahili. And they've never done it. Not once. They've never shown me what the base case is.
Just that he's that Joseph translates in the King James Version way, because translation is complicated and it's messy. And Joseph Smith, being unlearned farm boy, could only translate in this one way. So even though Nephi is, 900 years earlier than Mormon and they still speak the same, it's because Joseph Smith translated it that way. Now, a seasoned scholar would not do that. So if we were to bring in the gold plates to Fair, we would get a much richer translation, I guess.
Helping him translate, God speaks the King's
King
English.
James. Mm-hmm.
Well,
yes,
we're correct. Getting to the problem. I know we keep referring to this in podcasts. We've never done the podcast. The problem between the loose and the tight translation theories comes out here. But if I say I, Nephi, is an ancient Egyptian construction, you'd first of all have to say, this is not a 19th century English construction. That's the first thing you have to say. Look, this doesn't happen elsewhere in contemporary writings. Then you have to say, and it also doesn't appear in the Bible, because we're the premise is very clear that Joseph Smith is copying out of the Bible. Once you establish those two things, that there's a phrase in the Book of Mormon that's not congruent with 19th century English constructions, and it's not in the Bible, and it has a connection that you can display, and we're going to get to that in verse 2, then I'll pay attention. Then you've got something interesting. Otherwise, you're just throwing sand in everybody's eyes, and you guys know it. You know better.
So they're just cherry picking, really.
That's being generous.
Well, they need to find something concrete. Obviously, they never will. It's like how we know that the Gospels, the original language of the Gospels, were Greek, that they could not have been Aramaic, and so we know that Jesus could not have said the whole Nicodemus conversation, how can one be born again, to be born again of the Father, and all that stuff. That's a double entendre in Greek. And it makes no sense in Aramaic, because the Greek words for born again and born from above, like they're the same word, all this stuff. And so that betrays the case that the Gospels, the original language of the Gospel is Greek. So unless Jesus was talking to Nicodemus in Greek, we know that Jesus couldn't have said those things. And those are the kinds of things that you can concretely identify this kind of thing. With the Book of Mormon, they haven't got anything one way or the other.
Well, no, you said one way or the other. They do the other. It says in the Book of Mormon, I'm the Alpha and the Omega.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go.
You can't translate that into demonic Egyptian.
Do you want me to keep dropping these bombs? Because I can prove the Book of Mormon's true all night, baby.
Let's go to verse 2.
But real quick with the verse 1, going back to this exploring Nephi as the alter ego of Joseph, I was really caught up by this. The line here, therefore I was taught somewhat in all the learning of my father. Why is that somewhat in there? And in that case, from whence did Nephi get the great knowledge of the goodness and mysteries of God? Presumably from Lehi, but if he only got somewhat of the learning of the father... sticking in there?
Because in verse 5, he goes on and has the vision where he relays Lehi's vision, and then later in the book, he has it himself. So Lehi tells him about his vision with the pillar of fire and all the other hoo-ha, and then Nephi himself goes and says, I want this vision myself, then he has it. So it might be a precursor to that. It also might be that the Book of Mormon is extra wordy and it didn't have a good editor, and sometimes some of these words just needed to be scratched out.
Well, because they're all over this thing. You can almost feel Joseph changing his thought mid-sentence. which I think you see all, and I think this is an example of it, because that doesn't make sense.
Now, verse one is pristine. The Book of Mormon has been changed, has been altered. And since we're going through four verses, I will tell you where they've been altered. Verse one is as it stands under the most contemporary research, Skousen's research. So verse one is as it appears in the original transcript,
including the parenthesis.
There was a hyphen. They have you're right. Thane's correcting me. They did correct the punctuation. There was a dash right before nevertheless.
I keep hearing that they fixed the punctuation in the Book of Mormon, but really?
Well, fix. Fix. Fix is a strong term.
Move it around.
All right, verse two.
Hang on. So, okay, still with verse one. You think that Nephi is portraying himself very arrogantly, which might be the case, but I would contend that he is setting himself up as an authority figure, so when we get to verse three, we're just going to take his word for it, which we're not there yet, but I think he's setting the scene saying, hey, look, I've got this learning, I'm good with God, you know, I've got good parents, so well, you got listen to what I got to say.
Nephi, before the end of this book, throws everybody under the bus. His mom, his dad, all his brothers and sisters, like everybody, is not faithful. So you're right, he's establishing himself as this authority figure who is going to rescue the family and be the alpha.
He was like me at 14. I had it all figured out. I was not breaking the Sabbath. My family was going to Chuck-O-Rama on Sundays. Yep. I know how Nephi feels. It's rough being the most righteous one in your family. It's really hard.
It is.
Were you also the third born?
I was the second
born. I was the third born boy behind the other two.
Nice.
Why don't you just raise up your hand and
maybe
strike down your wicked
podcast is my alter egoing myself through Nephi through Joseph Smith. Huh?
And it's turtles all the way down.
All right. Verse 2. Yea, I make a record in the language of my father, which consists of the learning of the Jews and the language of the Egyptians.
Because sure, that's how that works.
Let's get ready this might be one of the most controversial verses in the whole book. Should we talk about the Egyptian language? Egyptian language is not a mystery to us. You know, we know all about it. Although at the time of Joseph, it seemed mysterious. And it went through evolutionary periods. As a matter of fact, linguists, theorize that all languages, all written languages, started, They started out as pictorial representations of things they would see in nature, and those pictures got shorthanded over time. And if you study languages where these things are still around, like Egyptian symbology, or there's some Native American languages, or Chinese characters, you can actually trace them back, and some of them you can still see, like, the Chinese character for a tree looks sort of like a tree, and there is the etymology of those written figures that appears. So there's this evolution of languages.
The lowercase a comes from Aleph, which was the ox, and it used to be, imagine a little circle with a little kind of curly thing attached to the top. It was an ox's head with horns, and it's evolved into our letter A, but it used, even Latin, a lot of the Latin letters started out as pictographic representations.
So you're absolutely right, and they evolved over time, and they became alphabetized. I'm not going to go through the full history of Egyptian, but what happened is that there were really, from this time period that we're talking about, there were really three modes of writing at the time. There were the hieroglyphics that you would see painted on temple walls. They were like the more pretty sort of, and we even see that now, that there will be different forms of writing. And I'll remind everybody, in Japanese right now, currently today, there are two full alphabet sets. One they use for native Japanese words, and one they use for foreign words. And there's a whole set of kanji of Chinese characters that have been incorporated. So they have three writing systems in Japan, in a Japanese newspaper, you pick up they use simultaneously that have been put together.
They kind of have four because Romanji is normalized Latin Japanese spelling. So every Japanese school kids learns katakana, hiragana, Romanji, and kanji.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you can pick up, I have seen a newspaper, a Vietnamese newspaper that was written entirely in Chinese characters. Because the Chinese character is pictographic. It doesn't necessarily have a phoneme attached to it. So you could, if you were really masochistic, kind of like one of those guys who learns to speak Klingon, you could write an English newspaper following English syntax in Chinese characters. It'd be a colossal pain in the ass, and you have to make a lot of leaps, but you could do it. So, and we'll circle back that a little bit. But, so there was the hieroglyphics that became, by this time, by 600 BC, had become very sort of ornamental. And they would be put, you know, like, if you see, like, tombstones or the end of movies, they still write years in Roman numerals. So this is a numeric system that's been dead to us for thousands of years, but people still use it ceremoniously today. So from that system, when the priests would write this, another system evolved called hieratic, which was sort of a cursive of those characters. But it would read much like a Chinese newspaper would read. They'd be able to read absolutely what it says. And at the time, in common usage was a writing system called demotic. And demotic really monopolized the time between 650 and about 450 BC. What evolved from there is Coptic, which, of course, if you've done studying the New Testament, you've heard about. But there is a rich, known, careful history of the writing of Egypt at the time. We have lots of examples. And like all languages, they evolved over time. So if you look at the English from the 19th century, and then you look at Shakespearean English, and then you read Chaucer, you can construct this evolution of languages. Languages do not reform. Any kind of reform movement on languages was a product of the late 19th century and the 20th century, and they were largely unsuccessful. What they would tend to do is try to reform spelling and other things. But these colleges of languages that you hear about today, they act like they're in control. They are not. Languages are organic things, and they can be studied as such. So we know all about Egyptian. The idea that there was another form of Egyptian that existed, that is completely lost, is absolutely ridiculous. It is beyond, if I were to argue that Napoleon lost the war because the Russians came out with laser beams, that would make more sense than to suggest that this language was there. Because there's a couple fundamental problems. We know demiotic. It's a script, just like Greek was at the time. It was an alphabetized language. We know all about it. No one has shown to date that there is any more efficient system of writing than an alphabet. It hasn't been done. But Joseph Smith is claiming in verse 2 that not only was it done in 600 BC, it was common knowledge, at least to his father. He learned it from his father, and he didn't say his father made it up. He said the learning of the Jews and the language of the Egyptians. But later they say that because this writing is more concise than Hebrew. But of all the known written systems of Egyptian we have, none of these scholars down at BYU have ever even tried to make the case that Egyptian is a more efficient writing system than Hebrew. Hebrew is an extremely efficient writing system because writing systems, when they evolved at the time, it was a pain in the fucking ass to write anything. And so you were very careful about what you wrote. Because it was an expensive proposition to teach anybody to read or write. That's why usually only the priestly class even had the time to do it. And if you were doing it, you had to have good motivation to do it. Like you were keeping, you know, like a lot of the early writings were religious, or they were tax documents and property documents and things that were very important to keep seasonality.
Well, it drives scholars of ancient texts crazy that just paper or whatever they were writing on was so precious that they find these things where they could see scribes learning, where they would use something over and over and over, and they'd write this way, and then they turn around and then write the other way, just while, you know, while they're learning their craft, and just because paper was that precious. And so they find these goofy things. They're just this jumbled mess of writing going in every direction.
Yeah, for sure. And, or it was disposed. Ostensibly in Egypt, one of the reasons culture progressed is because they could make paper, easy with the papyrus. But there's.
But you don't think God could preserve a way, if he wanted a story told, that he would raise up people to do it, preserve a way for them to do it, and give them the opportunity to do it that might be unique for the time?
It's, and then kill them all off immediately after it's written down so that they don't translate that off.
It's patently ridiculous.
But possible.
That given all the... that given all the language systems out there, that God would choose one that he would bury all the evidence that this language ever existed
at all.
What
if John C. Bennett got it? He would have taken it all kinds of crazy places.
John, who, what?
That's Hebrew.
You need to stop reading that fair stuff. You're stopping your...
I've got some great stuff for
God
you.
Could have solved all of this if he'd just given Joseph a frickin' library card. And he could have gone and checked out a book on Egyptian. And then he said, like, you know, I, Nephi, having been learned Demotic from Dad, wrote this book in Demotic.
Yes. but so the point is, when you, one of the things you do when you read, like, Nibley and these guys, they will pull from all sorts of languages and from all sorts of times. And it would be like trying to reconstruct my language by showing like a phoneme from Ireland in 1100 AD. You know, like the connection is, it's only 900 years, right? And it's from the same language family, right? And there were a lot of Irish people who came to the United States, right? During the same time. It's this increasingly improbable possibility. What apologists do is they do not, science is about probability and science is about logical consistency. Apologetics is about possibility. It's about, is there any possible way feasible that what I'm talking about could happen?
So you're just saying it's possible. Thank you. Thank you for.
Well, he's also saying that it's expressly not history, because, like he's saying, that, like they say in history all the time, history is not about what might have happened; it's about what probably happened.
Then how do you explain Nephi's word? Nephi, the word being an ancient Egyptian inscription. How would Joseph possibly know that?
Nephi. It's probably one of the easiest things to construct in the. I'm trying to think of like the. There's tongue placement around the mouth. Nephi is two syllables. It doesn't have any ending sound. I would be surprised if you could find me an ancient language where that phoneme construction doesn't happen, at least in some instance.
My given name is Filipe, and it's Portuguese, and I learned a long time ago that Filipe is a name in Tongan. How do you figure? It's a coincidence. Filipe. It's not that crazy that those three sounds would get smashed together in two different places in the world.
Do you want me to stop? Because I can.
No. Keep going. This is golden.
Okay. Well, what I find interesting is that around this time, like you said, there are very few people who actually knew how to write and who would dedicate their lives to writing. And they're usually, you know, scribes and, you know, very religious people, monks later in the Middle Ages. And even in the Middle Ages, which is many, many centuries in the future, very few people knew how to read and write. And before that became, reading and writing became popular and everybody knew how to do it, like we're used to today, it was oral history that was handed down. And the Bible started as an oral history and was written much, much later than when it was supposed to have happened. And that's happened with the New Testament, the Old Testament, but here we have the Book of Mormon that's supposedly being written as it's happening. And that's not very likely when you look at other historical documents. And the Quran is the same way. Muhammad didn't write anything down. He told it over and over and over again, and they wrote it later on, I think in 380.
Right, right, right. Well, and a lot of the Bible is that way. It's in verse. It was recited. There's good evidence linguistically that these things were around long before they were written. But let's talk about writing a little bit. So the Egyptians were writing on papyrus. If you take it and compare that to cuneiform, which was pressed into clay tablets, right? You can tell the difference between those two languages by looking at them, that there's a certain mode of production. So if you're a Hebrew speaker, like Nephi is, and you're going to be etching this thing on plates, Egyptian's not the language you choose. It's not a language that sort of evolved.
That's why he chose Reformed Egyptian. Duh.
Oh, Reformed.
It was Reformed to write on plates.
It was Reformed. It was, okay.
For the new medium.
Wait, I'm intrigued.
No, I won't keep you on your side. I have more to it, and it has to do with, and it came to pass. And why Joseph would take the time to translate it that way.
Oh, okay. But have we belabored the point about Egyptian enough? The language does not exist. It doesn't exist historically. It doesn't exist in the Book of Mormon. They'll pull out Hebrewisms, right? But wouldn't we be more likely to be able to pull out Egyptianisms? And more so, the book was written, for the most part, this part was preserved. Moroni said he just added this on, slap, that he did not edit this part. But the rest of it was written in 480, 1,000 years. 1,000 fucking years after they left Egypt with one Egyptian speaker, Nephi. And the farms guys argue that, like, Pahoran, that name that shows up is from Egyptian roots. That's patently ridiculous. If the book were right, we would see more and more like Mesoamerican languages creeping in over time. Especially now the church is saying, no, it wasn't the entire population of the United States, like it says in the scriptures. This was just a small subset that got completely subsumed genetically. Genetically, they were completely wiped out, but their language wasn't? Holy shit. That's incredible.
It's God's work.
It's God.
Okay, can I just read one paragraph? I want to illustrate your point, actually. I want to show you what they've done with Nephi's name. This illustrates exactly what you're saying. So they say a Phoenician inscription discovered at Elephantine contains the name of
Phoenician.
A certain K, the letters K-N-P-Y. This by itself is mere trivia. But scholarly discussion of the name connects it to the Book of Mormon. So some guy collected a name of personal names in Phoenician inscriptions and their different forms. He sees the name K-N-P-Y as the Phoenician form of K3-NFR.W, an attested Egyptian name. So this guy, some scholar has connected K-N-P-Y as an Egyptian name. So that's the connection there. It was later confirmed by G. Vittman, who added the Aramaic spellings K-N-W-P and Q-N-P-Y, which were also attested. Further, the Aramaic K-N-W-P-Y is attested in the Elephantine inscriptions. Vittman also noted the name H-R-N-P-Y, attested in Aramaic inscriptions, were probably Egyptian Neher-Nefer. The name element N-P-Y seems to be Semitic. And then they connect that with the vocalizations of NPY, which is Nephi. Nephi poses no problem.
Why the hell is there a PH in it?
I'm not a scholar, John.
That is so astoundingly unconvincing.
It's right here. It's from the Maxwell Institute.
If you want to have a fun adventure in how we're all actually speaking the same language, look up all the cognates for the word night. Like nighttime, because, you know, English night, German nicht, Spanish noche, Portuguese noche, Polish noc, Russian is noc, most of the Slavic languages are something like noc. You keep going, like Sri Lankan, it's like noce or something like that. It's not crazy that the Phoenicians might have a name that's similar people somewhere else.
Languages. Hey, here's my favorite example of how language changed. You know the King James Bible was written phonetically, right? So if you want to pronounce the King James Bible the way it was written, pronounce every letter. So if it says come, C-O-M-E, it should be coma. And then you can read you can read it. Now it's been altered, so we don't really have the original spelling. But if you find an old one, read it phonetically, and then you'll know how people were speaking. It's 1611. Languages change, and they're full of all sorts of funky stuff. And the language change we would expect to see happening in the Book of Mormon does not happen. And the language change that these guys argue for is scant and ridiculous. And just like I just said, the PH. Why is there a PH in Nephi? Why?
Phoenician.
It makes no sense whatsoever. Why would they not spell it phonetically? Why would they choose the PH? Why would they choose that construction? To me, it speaks to the fact that he's looking and trying to make it as cool as he can, because it looks better to him.
Yeah, and all the translations, they just spell them phonetically. Like all the in the Portuguese version of the Book of Mormon, the Nephi is spelled N-E-F-E or N-E-F-I, you know, because all they do is alter it for the phonemes that are native to the language, but they don't add any magic.
That's because they weren't farm boys translating it, you guys.
All right. Verse 3. Did somebody ask how we are going to spend an hour talking about four verses of the Book of Mormon? All right. Verse 3. And I know that this record which I make is true, and I make it with my own hands, and I make it according to my knowledge. This is verse 3. Okay? If you ever go out on a first date with somebody, and one of the first things they do is they say, I'm a really honest person. Run away. Because honest people don't make that claim in the first fucking paragraph of their book. Why would you say, I write this book and it's true, unless it was coming into your mind that it might not be true? You don't say that. I mean, go look at a TED talk. Nobody gets up and says, I'm going to tell you some true stuff. Pay attention here. People do not say that unless they're about to lie.
Some people say that. We hear that often at conference.
We do hear it often at conference. Thank you.
So verse 3 is the one that I just love, because he's making an appeal to authority, the authorities himself, and he established that authority in the first verse.
It's a funny thing. There's a little image you'll see on the internet that gets passed around. It has a picture of a napkin, and it says, the napkin church is the only true church because it says so on this napkin. That's exactly what it says in verse 3, right? I make a record and I know that the record which I make is true, and I make it with my own hands, and I make it according to my knowledge, because the book told us it is. This book is true because the book just told us it's true in verse 3.
But he was born of goodly parents. Why would he lie?
Exactly.
Well, Laman and Lemuel were born of the same womb.
Sometimes that happens.
Indeed.
Well, Nephi goes and slanders their name later on, so you can't believe them.
So now we have a learned Jew who's writing in Egyptian, who's telling us the truth about everything that's going to fall. That's what we've established in verse 3.
Nephi might be an Egyptian word, but Lehi is Hebrew. It means your jawbone. I learned that today.
You know,
Nibley doesn't think that. He thinks that's not good enough, so he translates it to mean some sort of like the land of our fathers.
But I could also argue that Nephi lived not very far from the Lehigh Valley up in upper state New York.
Oh, you mean the Jawbone Valley. Okay.
Okay.
Something I wanted to raise before, but I'm trying not to belabor the whole thing, but about the Egyptian, do we have any idea what Joseph was thinking? Why did he pull Egyptian into this? Why not just stick with Hebrew?
Well, if you read the Old Testament, if you read Genesis, Genesis has a sort of a love affair with the Egyptians.
Yeah.
And I think,
as did Joseph.
And I think Joseph pulled it out of there. And at the time, this is before it was translated, there were expeditions, like Napoleonic expeditions and stuff, going through that at the turn of the century, between the 1700s and 1800s, that this had started capturing the imagination of this ancient, lost culture that people didn't really understand. And the Greeks had long sort of put the Egyptians up as sort of this interesting sort of birthplace of civilization. So I think the idea that it sparked Joseph Smith's imagination and gave him this plausible deniability between Hebrew and this other culture, because it's going through this strange translation of Egyptian. And it explains, because the people would say, I mean, think about it, if he didn't put this in, he said, I found this book, and it was written in Hebrew. Well, there'd be plenty of people, like, just down the street who would say, really? Because, you know, Reuben over here reads Hebrew. Bring it here, and he'll tell you what it says. But at the time, nobody in America could read Egyptian. So it was all gobbledygook to everybody. You'd have to have the power of God to translate.
I would just like to point out that Fair actually does say that at the time Lehi would have been living, that Egypt and Jews didn't get along. They were enemies. So the fact that Lehi, a Jew, speaking Egyptian is God's work made manifest. a miracle.
It's funny, because that point comes up from what you're saying.
Was Lehi like a business traveler? Why did he know Egyptian?
I can send you an article. Would you like to know?
The apologists say he was a merchant. Now, we all forget this, but the Suez Canal, the Suez Peninsula, I think is only 70 or 90 miles from Jerusalem. Like, that area there, everything's in pretty tight, together. So, but you're right. They were constantly at war with one another. So it wouldn't be unheard of in a crossroads town like Jerusalem. Israel was a pissant country, when you look at the powers that be around it, except it was in this strategic place where armies always met. Either the Greeks or the Romans or the Babylonians, or the Phoenicians or the Egyptians. It was this constant battleground. It was the Poland of its time. And it's just where things came together. And that's why they were important, not because they had great political power. Okay. Verse 4. And it came to pass in the commencement of the first year of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah. Let's stop there. Let's talk about Zedekiah. Zedekiah is in the Bible. And, this is one point I want to make about apologetics. But Bible scholars generally believe that the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah was 597. But there's a wide range that they argue about. But the generally accepted date, based on biblical construction, is 597. The Book of Mormon places this at 600. I want to take a window into the mind of apologetics. Because they offer theories that have no way to be proven wrong. Because of the revelation. So if in the Book of Mormon they had said this was 597, they would say, see, here's proof that the Book of Mormon is true. Now in science, you have to have a falsifiable statement, which means if it's true, it establishes your case, and if it's false, it doesn't establish your case. In apologetics, both cases always win. And in this case, they'll say, well, the Bible's wrong. The Book of Mormon's right. It was actually 600 years because we know that through Revelation. If the Book of Mormon gets a hit, which it very, very rarely does, but if the Book of Mormon gets a hit, it's evidence the Book of Mormon is true. If the Book of Mormon does not get a hint, it's a revelation. It's an apparency that science is wrong, right? There's no falsifying the Book of Mormon at all. So here you have something that's scholars all around would routinely look at and say, nope, that can't be. That's wrong. But they would still move forward with it.
Agreed.
All right, so the Zedekiah thing's not as interesting as the
I mean, we could break. They go in. They have this love affair with everyone's names. Apparently, there's a lot of. I mean, a lot of scholarship that has to do with all the names in the Book of Mormon. So,
Before we move on to the second half of verse 4, I do want to. I did go through and look to see where there were changes from the modern. Book of Mormon and the old one. The original one in verse 3 said, and I know that the record which I make to be true. And the new one says, and I know the record which I make is true. That's just most of the errors in the Book of Mormon are grammatical in nature, and that's very typical. But
they didn't fix Goodly. Because Egyptian is complicated.
Well, one would have to go through and see, and I'm sure Farms would love to fund this research, and grammar, most native speakers of a language, like 99.99% of speakers of a language, do not speak ungrammatically. They speak grammatically correct for their regionality, right? It's very rare for somebody to actually autonomously produce bad grammar. Everything we call bad grammar is actually two different modes of speaking English. And if you take, I don't know, like using the old-fashioned term Ebonics from the South, you would find that there is a systematic grammar to that is absolutely consistent for people who speak that. And it'd be interesting to go through and say, is the grammar, relevant with the production of Chosa Smith at the time?
There is a project that is going on right now, and I can't remember the name of it. Maybe someone in the audience knows, where they are comparing the Book of Mormon with contemporary manuscripts at the time. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, and I have the same objection against that I have against these Farms and Fair scholars, which is, if they're going to go through and say the Book of Mormon appears to be written from this book, written in 1815, well, show me 100 random books and show me what your computer algorithm shows. Because what I've seen of their research, they've got these two books are saying, hey, Joseph Smith copied these two books. Show me what the null case is. Show me what any two random books from the 19th century, when you run them through your software, come up as. And they haven't done that yet. And until they do it, it's the same bullshit that the Farms guys are putting out.
I wouldn't say the same, but...
Well,
it's exactly like the Bible code, all that, they do the statistical thing on the Bible code, and you find all this stuff, and then researchers have done hilarious stuff, like put Harry Potter in there, and it predicts 9/11.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it works. It's just random noise.
The Book of Mormon predicts a civil war. Just kidding. That was the doctrine
of covenants. Okay, so the second half of verse 14. My father Lehi, having dwelt at Jerusalem in all of his days, and the same year there came many prophets prophesying unto the people they must repent, or the great city Jerusalem must be destroyed. Okay, the apologists jump on this dwelling at Jerusalem, and they use it later to show that he didn't live in Jerusalem, that he just lived like in the suburbs, that Lehi actually lived in like the sandy of Jerusalem, and he wasn't in like downtown.
But this comes up later when the Book of Mormon says Jesus was born in Jerusalem, right? And they have the exact same argument.
Right. And it comes to the question, well, why would a city dweller in Jerusalem speak Egyptian or whatever? And it's like, well, he's at Jerusalem. He's actually like a caravan sort of guy going around to the Sinai Peninsula, and that's where he learned Egyptian.
But it says he was there in all his days. So it doesn't say like, oh, well, he wandered around.
It is. The book does have its problems.
Yeah.
I will acknowledge your point. Many prophets prophesying to the people that they must repent or the city would be destroyed. Scholars reckon that Jerusalem was, the first Babylonian captivity happened in 587. According to the Book of Mormon narrative, 13 years is kind of a lead for that a little bit. And Jerusalem wasn't really destroyed. It was hammered. The point is everything is so loose. You can say whatever you want in scripture. You can say it was destroyed and it's close enough. Cause there were people that were left there.
He had to write on freaking gold plates. I would sum it up, too, in one big word that meant a lot of things.
Well, what about that first verse that I read? I, Nephi, blah, 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 blah.
That was left by God to prove to us that it was true because he spoke ancient Egyptian. See, you can't... you know what? We don't have enough time for me to give all the arguments
for you to prove. So the first four verses... It's just riddled with all sorts of weirdness and problems and lack of understanding of the culture, of the language, of the biblical history. It makes apparently mistake after mistake after mistake in four verses. It makes grammatical errors in English. It doesn't understand language. It doesn't have the years right for the king. It does things like claim it's true in the very first passage. it's just riddled with all sorts of weirdness. And the book just goes from here on. And this is the most true and correct of any book that has ever been written. And, you can just see the problems in it. What's fascinating to me personally is how much when I read the book for the first 30 years of my life, how it was impossible to read. I love to read, and, I remember as a linguistic student trying to puzzle my way through some old Bali scripts, some old religious writing. And I even loved to read the Bible. And just the Book of Mormon was like my mind slamming into a brick wall. And I kept thinking, what the hell is wrong with me? Here is the book for our time. But now I read it and I see this. What are you laughing at, Lindsay?
I just had a joke that you probably looked at porn before you read it, and mind was blocked.
When I was young, these damn kids today, when I was young, porn was hard to find. You had to work. You had to bribe people.
Here we go again.
You had to bribe
the
older
kids. You
kids
and your access to porn.
Nobody should mention, nobody should bring this up, but I did not masturbate for 2 years. For the majority of my duration of my mission, and the Book of Mormon never made any goddamn sense to me.
Notice he said majority. Let me tell you that's the best you can do.
I count 2 years.
There were 720 days.
I do have to say that this is the first time I've had this conversation about masturbating and reading the Book of Mormon in the same sentence. So thank you for that.
So the Book of Mormon, it's rough. And I remember something I'd read. I don't even remember where I read it. It was years before I left the church. That a scholar said, read the Book of Mormon like you would read any other book. And at first, for a couple of years, I didn't understand it. And then I got it. Because what happens is we give it deference. We say, this is a holy scripture. This is something special. And if I'm not getting it, something's wrong with me. It sounds very much, we talk about the Book of Mormon like an abused spouse talks about their relationship with their abuser. It must be me. You know, it's true. I did not mop the floor today, so the Book of Mormon hit me, and I deserve it. But the Book of Mormon will be back tomorrow, and I know the Book of Mormon loves me, and I just gotta be better.
And I know it's true.
And,
because Nephi said so.
Come on, Lindsay, that was a good one. but no, it's not you. It's not. It's the book.
I do want to say, my friend Chris is here sitting in the audience, and we had this conversation about, and I would love this to be its own podcast, about the book Mary Shelley in the Book of Mormon. And he was saying, you know, if you were told to read Frankenstein's book by Mary Shelley every day and told that it was the best book ever, the most correct book ever, and from a young age you read that book every single day, of course you would think it was fantastic because you were taught every single day how amazing it was. So even if it didn't make sense and you're like, you know, I really don't relate to Frankenstein, you would know that you would have to because everyone else around you was pulling out these great lessons from it.
And the other thing is that Mary Shelley was like 18 when she busted that.
That's what I'm saying. It's a whole podcast. We got to get you on to talk about it.
It'd be interesting to see how many Phoenician like inscriptions, constructions show up in, because it's not zero. I guarantee you that. All right. Any other thoughts about the first four verses?
I think it was traumatizing having to read them again. It brought back some really bad memories.
It's a fun book. All right. So, where do we need to finish up? I think our standard finish up, as always, the discussion continues over at the website at mormonexpression.com. You can see our live recording schedule, every Tuesday night in Salt Lake City, here at the fabulous studio. It's at 423 West 800 South. A110 around in the back. It's free of charge. People ask me that. Maybe I'm giving them the wrong answer. Check out whitefieldseducational.org. See our fabulous workshops that are coming up. Anything else that you're working on, Lindsay?
Nope. Just keep being awesome out there.
A special thanks to Charles Stoddard, who is our sound engineer tonight, and to everybody here tonight. Good night, everybody. Thanks.